And a special welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. With you every Sunday, 3 to 5, talk about the critical issues of life. Giving you a piece of my mind. And generally, you can give me a piece of yours. Our first hour together, though, lines are shut down. You'll be able to get on board hour number 2. We have a guest in studio, and one of my favorite interviews, frankly. He's great to talk to him. He's got a lot of information, a lot of background in a very vital area, very focused, and has just written a new book. His name is Dr. Fuzz Rana. He's with Reasons to Believe, and his new book is Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. Fuzz, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Greg, for having me.
Is this your first book in this area? I'm trying to remember if we've done anything with you before. I know Dr. Ross has written before, and he co-authored a portion of this book.
This is the first book.
Yeah, and this is an area that's really personal to you because this whole issue of origin of life has been something that really made a difference for you as a young scientist and answering these foundational primary questions about meaning and life and everything else, right?
That's right. The origin of life question as a young graduate student intrigued me as I was learning about the cell's chemical systems. The obvious question is, well, where do these systems come from? And as I looked at the different models that were being advocated at that time, this was the mid-80s, to explain the origin of life's chemical systems, I just found them, frankly, woefully inadequate to account for the elegance and the sophistication of the cell's chemical systems, and had an intuition at that time based on that inadequacy that there seemed like there was more than just chemistry and physics necessary to bring life into existence. I wasn't a Christian at the time. This was from an evolutionary background,
right?
You know, and a fairly negative view of Christianity that I approached this whole issue of the origin of life initially.
Dr. Rana, this is not unusual, though, for people. I mean, I've heard other testimonies like this, especially in the field, where you have people coming from an evolutionary background. They're in the discipline. You're on your way to doing PhD work at the time. You now have your PhD in
Chemistry. With an emphasis in biochemistry.
In biochemistry, which is exactly the field that we're concerned about here. So this is in your ken, as it were. And lots of other people then just were brought up short when they looked at the evidence for the evolutionary model, given the complexity of life that they're facing. And this has caused a turnaround for them that was not driven, in a sense, theologically initially.
Right. It was purely scientific that drove me to the conclusion that there had to be a creator, at least in terms of bringing the very first life forms into existence.
Now you say in the beginnings of your book, Origins of Life, that this, strictly speaking, is not a book against evolution. Meaning what?
Well, it's not a book about life's history on Earth or the origin of humanity and how do you explain that, but rather it's about the very first stages in the process of biological evolution, if you will, the foundational idea to biological evolution, namely, how did life come from non-life if you were a naturalist, an evolutionist? In other words, where did life come from? If you're going to argue that all of life's history is explicable strictly through an evolutionary process, a natural process, biological evolution, I think you have to have a continuum between a complex chemical mixture, a prebiotic soup, and life's history in order to legitimately argue that biological evolution is a sound scientific idea. It's a pillar, if you will, that supports the whole edifice of biological evolution.
I'm glad you used that word because, you know, at Stand to Reason, what we're in the business of translating. So we let you guys do the hard work, and then we learn what you said, although this book is not hard to follow at all, and I want my listeners to understand that. But we take what you've said, and we try to put it in the most accessible way possible. And so when I think of this whole enterprise of Darwinian evolution, the macroevolution or the general theory of evolution, it has a kickoff and then there's a game, as it were. There's what we call it, two pillars of the evolutionary enterprise. And the first pillar is the kickoff, and that's life from non-life. And the second pillar is how do you get, once you've got life, to all the various forms of life that you have now. And so in your book, you're not taking on the whole enterprise. Other books have done so in a more general thing. You're taking a more microscopic look at this foundational problem. Can the Darwinian model explain the kickoff, given the facts that we know about life today and the early Earth conditions then?
That's right. That's the focus of the book. And it's interesting because oftentimes you'll see evolutionary biologists try to sidestep the origin of life question And they'll argue, we're not worried about how life began. Right, but once we had life, what happened? And I think as Christians, we should not let them get by with that, because that is totally illegitimate in my view.
Yeah,
the whole thing is interconnected.
Sure.
It's a continuum. It's not this or and that.
You know, it's interesting because I've run into the same thing, Fuzz. When I've been in the field and raising this issue, and I point to the serious problems with the origins of life, with the kickoff of the enterprise, this is the move that they make. They say, well, wait a minute. Darwinism is about the development of life. It isn't about the origin of life. And my response, of course, is this isn't true even in the field, as you know, because there are large – the International Society for the Study of Origin of Life is a Darwinist enterprise. And whenever they come up with something that seems to support their Darwinian evolutionary model, they're going to grab that right away and run with it. It's only when the evidence goes against them that they want to distance themselves from this as if it's not part of the enterprise. But it is strategically important in the whole model.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So so the book deals with the origins of life. And frankly, when I talk about this myself and I talk about this pillar, in part because of my conversations with you in the past, this is the one I think we can take to the bank more than anything else, because very simply put, and let me use this as a kind of a springboard comment so you can get into the material of the book and the way you organize this material. I tell people with regards to the origin of life, here's the kickoff. How did life come from non-life? And the answer is nobody knows. In fact, nobody even knows really how it could be possible that such a thing could take place. This is a place where there is such a dismal failure with regards to the scientific community, and you're nodding at everything I've said here. So let me just let's start right there and tell us how you build from you build to that point in the book.
Well, you know, we kind of start the book off by essentially making that point, and we cite a number of knowledgeable outside observers who are not original life researchers as such, but are knowledgeable observers who have a naturalistic bent. Paul Davies is one person we cite, who wrote a book on the origin of life himself, and he makes the comment, when I started writing the book, I thought this was a done deal, because mm-hmm. there's this perception, you know, from high school biology textbooks through just what we see in the news when we read about work that origin of life researchers are engaged in, that this is a done deal. This is, you know, an open and shut case. We're just putting in the final touches. Mm-hmm. Well, when Paul Davies began digging, you know, underneath the surface, he realized nobody has a clue at what's going on.
He's an astronomer, though, isn't he?
He's a physicist.
Physicist, okay.
But he has always been intrigued by the origin of life question and wrote a very good book mm-hmm. in many respects that from a skeptical standpoint. Mm-hmm. But his whole point is that you would be forgiven if you would argue that the life's origin was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other Francis Crick, who just died recently, had this classic quote, mm-hmm. you know, where he says, an honest man armed with all the information we have now could only conclude that in some way life's mm-hmm. origin must be a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here are some eminent scientists who are saying this seems to be miraculous. But the question is, well, why don't they go down that route?
Mm-hmm.
If they think that life's origin very well may be miraculous, why don't they go down that route?
I think of Robert Shapiro's book at New York University, one of the eminent, preeminent researchers in the area. In his book, now it's probably about 12 years old now, but it's, I think the title was Origins, A Skeptic's Guide to the Creation of Life on Earth. And here creation, in his view, is the naturalistic creation of life that is under question here in your book. The irony here is that, of course, I read this 14 years ago when it first came out, and he really, from an evolutionary perspective, says, we have nothing here. We have nothing. Last spring, 4 months ago, I was at Texas A&M, and I stayed at a bed and breakfast there that Dr. Shapiro had stayed at the night before I got there. I missed him for breakfast, you know, and I really was bugged because I would have liked to have talked to him about where things are now. But the people who were there and had breakfast with him said he was there spouting off the same thing. In other words, persisting in his conviction here now 12 years later that there's nothing there that the evolutionists have that can really advance their case for origin of life without design.
That's right. In fact, it's real interesting to watch him at these Origin of Life meetings. Hugh and I went to a couple of meetings in the last 3 or 4 years. Every 3 years, there's a huge global meeting where all mm-hmm. the world's best Origin of Life researchers gather.
This is the ISSOL, right?
That's
right. International Society for the Study of Origin of Life.
Right.
Last met in San Diego in 99, right?
And then there's a meeting in 2002 in Oaxaca, Mexico that Hugh and I went to.
Uh-huh.
And we both wound up with Montezuma's Revenge. And so that, there's a lot of pain in that book. But anyway, it was very interesting to watch Robert Shapiro at both meetings because he's just this gadfly that just pesters the Origin of Life community, and they have to admit that he's correct. But there was a real interesting paper presented by a guy named Jim Ferris, who argues that RNA molecules can assemble on clay surfaces. Mm-hmm. And when you look at his experimental design, it's just so contrived. And after he gave this talk, Shapiro raised his hand, sitting in the front row, and said, if you've done anything, what you've demonstrated is that life's origin has to be the product of an intelligent designer, mm-hmm. because in order to get this to work, there's just so much researcher input. Mm-hmm. So it's real interesting to watch Robert Shapiro make those types of comments. And, of course, Jim Ferris was very angry at that. But mm-hmm. the fact of the matter is Shapiro is right.
This you mentioned the RNA problem. You cover this later in the book as kind of a chicken and the egg problem, because there's a how do you get RNA? You've got to have something else, but you've got to have that other thing. You have to have RNA to produce that other thing. So you have these kind of conundrums that you're faced with. Basically, though, in your book, first you acknowledge this problem, which is, as I mentioned to our listeners, this is something you can take to the bank. Everybody in the industry understands that they don't have much to stand on right now. And so you take a look at the natural history approach to life's origin. Oh, I'm sorry. Once you look at the facts or the setting the stage of the history, then you offer two models. And you do that because of some objections that, as you cite, Eldridge from Harvard has made with regards to the creationist model or creationism not being scientific. His objection is different than Richard Dawkins would make. That's got a religious conclusion, therefore it's not scientific for those reasons. But Eldridge is making a different point that you're responding to. What is that point?
He basically is saying that anytime you appeal to the supernatural, it's basically religion. And he distinguishes religion from science in that religion is based on faith. Its ideas, its tenets are taken as dogma. We can, of course, mm-hmm. take that apart in a number of different ways. And he argues that science is very different, where its ideas are established by the rigors of scientific investigation. You develop models or theories or hypotheses. They have logical outworkings. Those serve as predictions. Does future scientific investigation satisfy those predictions? Can that model or that framework guide future scientific mm-hmm. research? And so he argues that really any appeal to a creator or to an intelligent designer falls in the domain of religion because there's no model, there's mm-hmm. no theory, there's no hypothesis.
So the twist here for Niles Eldridge from Harvard is that you guys have to all offer a testable alternative model. You can't just be naysayers throwing rocks at us from the sidelines. Of course, we're on the sidelines because that's where they pushed us, kind of thing. But you can't just try to beat up on evolution. Because we understand we have our problems. You've got to offer something that does the job better. And this is what your project here is in this book. And, in fact, RTB itself in the last couple of years has been a major thrust of your enterprise at
right.
Reasons to Believe.
Right. I mean, in some respects, I think Eldridge has a legitimate point. Mm-hmm. And as we're involved in apologetics, I think we need to acknowledge legitimate points
sure.
that our opponents make.
Right.
And I, as a scientist, I can understand his concern. Okay, if we go down this route, how then do I do my experiments? Because a theory or a model is the framework in which all the data is interpreted. It provides the guiding direction for future investigation.
It dictates what questions you're going to ask of
exactly,
the evidence, right?
Exactly. So I can understand his concern, but you know, we would argue that you can go to Scripture. You can start with certain presuppositions about the nature of the designer if you take a more of an idea approach versus a biblical
intelligent
creation.
Design, right?
Yeah, a biblical creation approach. But either way, you can start with certain presuppositions or you can start mm-hmm. with the biblical text. And from that, as you understand what the passage is teaching about God's work as a creator, you can then recast that understanding in scientific terms. Mm-hmm. There's going to be logical outworkings that you can then that then serve as the predictions for the model that you can test.
So you can tell Niles Eldridge, look, you can't push us off the field just because we come to religious conclusions. Now, you got a legitimate beef that we've got to have a project.
Exactly.
Okay? So we're using – we can have our project informed by theological concerns, but we can't prove our project by our theological evidence. We're going to prove our project though informed by theological concerns, we're going to prove our project with the in the legitimate way that science does its work. We're going to give you a model and we're going to test it.
That's a very good way to put it, mm-hmm. far better than I did.
So I'll just sum it up what you said in the book. So what you have then is a model that you're going to pit against the evolutionary model. Now, how do you characterize your model? What does that look like?
Well, we basically argue that Genesis 1-2 is the place in Scripture that implies something akin to what the scientific community would understand as the origin of life. And Genesis 1-2 is describing the earth in its primordial state. And
you mean chapters 1 and 2?
No, just Genesis 1-2, the single verse.
The second verse of the first chapter.
Yeah, it's describing the earth in its primordial state.
Uh-huh.
And it talks about the Spirit of God hovering over the waters.
Mm-hmm.
And we argue that based on Deuteronomy 32:9-12, which is a passage that comprises part of the Song of Moses,
mm-hmm.
and that every theologian argues that that passage has deep connections to Genesis 1-2.
Mm-hmm.
But from that, we argue that the Spirit of God hovering over the earth is doing more than just merely being present, that the Spirit of God is at work doing something very special.
Mm-hmm.
And so we suggest perhaps this is something akin to creating the very first life forms, which would have been single-celled organisms. We understand that from the scientific record. So we're just suggesting that could that be where the origin of life is mm-hmm. being described, if at all, in Scripture. And then we take that and say, well, if that's the case, then Genesis 1-2 describes the backdrop conditions under which life should originate.
Mm-hmm.
Very early in the Earth's history, the Genesis 1-2 implies that the Earth was in a state of desolation.
Mm-hmm.
This phrase tohu wa bohu, which
right.
is translate
formless
and void. So we would say life should appear early under conditions that we would recognize as being hostile
mm-hmm.
or harsh with respect to life, and that we also argue that if a creator is involved, that we would expect, life should appear suddenly, that life's chemistry should appear designed. So those are the types of predictions mm-hmm. that we make, and that's the general framework of our model.
And you have a whole list of what those are. You call your model the RTB model.
We struggled for what to call it.
Yeah, so you might as well just write. You know, you got the Oprah model. You know, you've got these scientists that name their model after their, you know, whatever. So now we've got the RTB model. That's great. And so you've got 6, 7, 8 predictions that form the structure of your model by which you will then assess the evidences that follow against. And or against which you will assess the evidence that follows. And we're about to go to break here, but I just wanted to draw attention to something here because I know that, you know, some people are going to think, well, wait a minute, that's kind of maybe you're reading a lot into Genesis 1 verse 2 and you're making it do more work. And strictly speaking, though, for a scientific model, it doesn't really matter where you get your ideas from. The fact is, the history of science is filled with all kinds of zany things. People got hit on the head with things. They woke up from a dream. They had visions. They had all kinds of screwy things that suggested the idea, which was then put to the test.
The key is putting the idea to the test.
Right,
that's
right,
the key.
Right. And so the origin maybe of the idea would mean a lot for Christians.
Right.
It's grounded in Scripture, and there's some defense of that. But it shouldn't matter to the secularist where the idea comes from. Maybe you just thought it up. The question is whether the idea, however organized and comprised, fits the evidence as you have it. And that's your project.
That's exactly right.
That's your project. And, of course, then it's going to be over and against a competing project called the Evolutionary Project, specifically regarding the origin of life. And may the best project win.
That's right.
Kind of thing. Okay, we're going to look at some of the evidence when we come back. I'm talking with Dr. Fuzz Rana. He's the Vice President of Science Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. You recognize, of course, the organization founded by Dr. Hugh Ross. His new book, co-authored with Dr. Ross, Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. InterVarsity Press is the publisher, and they've done it. Fuzz, you've done a great job in writing
Thank
this.
You.
I know it's technical work, but you've made it very accessible. It was very easy to outline and follow and to read through, and it's just a fascinating work, and it's great that you're focusing in on this major pillar, which if this pillar falls, boy, the whole Darwinian enterprise is gone. This is the roots of the tree. And this is a great way to deal with the problem. Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. Dr. Fuzz Rana. More with Dr. Rana and Stand to Reason after this. How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea, cruising the Alaskan coast, along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
All right, back with you here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, giving you a piece of my mind today, along with my guest, Dr. Fuzz Rana, Vice President of Science Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. His PhD in biochemistry is the academic backdrop for his new book, Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. He's here in studio with me, along with his sweet daughter, Mackenzie. How old is Mackenzie?
12.
He's 12. So she's given moral support today.
That's right.
So it's great to have you. Hear the giggles in the background there. She's off mic, but she doesn't have a lot to contribute today. She's just admiring her dad. Although she doesn't understand what he's talking about a lot of the times when we talk about this stuff, but soon you will. Your book, it deals with, as we mentioned earlier, one of the pillars of the whole evolutionary enterprise. You're not going after the general theory in toto, as it were. You are dealing with the roots of the enterprise. How do you get life from non-life? And you mentioned that it's well known in the field that there is no evidence for life from non-life. In fact, the field is somewhat in disarray, and we'll learn about some of the exotic kinds of solutions that people have attempted to go to because of the problems there. You have offered not just an alternative intelligent design, but a particular way that alternative can be worked out and tested using the methods of science. You have a project, and RTB, I know for the last 3 or 4 years especially, has really focused in on, let's do more than just beat up on the evolutionists. Let's give them a project in their language, an alternate proposal, and let's see how those predictions and the project survive against the facts. Now, the alternate project, of course, is the evolutionary project. You cited some of the predictions in RTB's model, that life would appear early in Earth history, that it originated and persisted through hostile conditions of early Earth, that it appears abruptly, that there's complexity in Earth's first life. It's even complex in its most minimal form, and it has the hallmarks of design and on through. You have 8 particular points, and this is what follows from your convictions about design.
Right.
Okay?
You know, and it's important to realize, too, that our model is not hyper-detailed. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking for scientific study to help fill in the details, additional theological studies to help fill in the details of the model. There's plenty of room for people to offer variants of the model. you know, but it what we're offering in terms of our predictions are kind of a framework or boundaries or broad brush strokes as to what should be true if our model indeed is valid.
In general, and this is exactly the way the scientific enterprise is supposed to work, because you have the flexibility to adjust now as new information comes in.
Right.
And this should put to death the objection that if you go to ID, there's some kind of creator, intelligent designer out there that's the end of science. There's nothing more to do.
Right. And in fact, I really look at this book as being the first step. And my hope is that this isn't the RTB model, but eventually there will be a flourishing of models within this category of models. Mm-hmm. And that what we've done is simply inaugurated the process, and that really we're looking for this to be a community endeavor, as mm-hmm. all science is, where people come to the table, they're free to critique our model, they're free to offer their alternative to our model. If it's another variant of our model that turns out to be correct mm-hmm. and it's not the one that we present here in the book, I would be thrilled.
That's why you say this isn't the biblical model, this isn't the Christian model, this is the RTB of way of understanding the foundational Christian commitment that God is responsible for the origin of life in the universe.
That's right. I'm
specifically our origin of life here, which is what you're speaking. Now, given those predictions of the RTB model, what are the predictions of the evolutionary model? If evolution is true in the sense that it's being advanced, the general theory of evolution, the molecules to man hypothesis, then what kind of things should we expect to find in the record?
Right, and it's important to realize that there's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation between our predictions and the predictions from the evolutionary framework. But one key prediction is that there's got to be a source of prebiotic compounds on the Earth, and there has to be clear evidence in the geological record that there was a prebiotic soup or a primordial soup.
Okay, and what are those things, the primordial soup, prebiotic
right.
soup, prebiotic
well,
compound?
Well, that's essentially the heart of the evolutionary model for the origin of life, is that on the early Earth, or at least in some location, a complex chemical mixture formed through natural means alone, through the atmospheric and geological chemistry of the Earth, and these compounds reacted over a vast period of time to generate more complex molecules that aggregated by some means to form a protocell mm-hmm. that in turn evolved through chemical and some quasi form of biological evolution to generate the first true cellular entity that then ultimately spawned this evolutionary tree of life.
Okay, so if in the most simple terms, if a living cell is something of a structure like an erector's like if you think of an erector set,
right.
there's got a structure like made out of an erector set. Well, there's right. got to be an erector set disassembled
right.
somewhere in the history of the Earth such that the pieces could later through some means be assembled into these cells.
That's exactly
what you mean by prebiotic soup, Darwin's pond, or different ways of characterizing.
That's right. That's exactly right. But that's the key – that is the linchpin prediction mm-hmm. in my mind, because if you don't have a prebiotic soup, if you don't have these prebiotic compounds, there's nothing to work with.
Nothing to build with.
There's nothing to build with.
Right.
Now, also, the model would predict that life should emerge under relatively benign, placid chemical and physical conditions, because under high energy conditions, but either physically or chemically – these compounds that form that are part of the prebiotic soup that would be the more complex molecules are going to fall apart. They're mm-hmm. relatively fragile molecules. So you can't really have vast periods of time where there's harsh conditions.
So it's to go back to my erector set illustration then, if you have the parts there and they somehow begin to assemble into some kind of structure, but then you keep having these landslides and these boulders rolling over the top of them, knocking them apart – that's the hostile environment that's going to make it difficult for them to get their project going to the way they need
to.
Yeah,
that's
right?
a good way of thinking of it. That's
okay.
exactly right. You know, also you'd expect the very first life forms to be relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd expect life to emerge over a vast period of time. In the early origin of life literature, the thought was maybe it was about a billion years
mm-hmm.
in order for life to emerge. There's this vast percolation time in order for life to emerge. So those would be some of the predictions that we can probe for scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
Is there evidence for a prebiotic soup in the geological record? What was the very first life forms like? What's minimal life like? Those are things that we can address.
It's the geological record that is the scientific material that you're working with to try to answer these questions. You're looking back in time into the fossil record to see what evidence of these kinds of things do we have.
Right.
Okay, now with those two models in place, let's talk about the, as you call it in your book, the facts of life, a whole section that is really dealing with these prebiotic conditions, the early Earth history, Whether there's a sudden or gradual appearance of life. What are the facts as we know them? And these are not the interpretive stage. This is just what does it seem like we know about the conditions themselves?
Well, this is the thing that's, I think, remarkable for not only me but for the scientific community in general, is that life appears extremely early in Earth's history, far earlier than anyone could have ever imagined. The Earth, in my view, dates to about 4.5 billion years in age. It's not until about 3.9 billion years that you have an Earth that's able to sustain life. That's when the Earth cools from a very harsh molten state to the crust forms. You have oceans that are established for the first time as permanent features on the planet.
And you got to have the water.
Mm-hmm. And about
liquid water, right?
Right, right. So the oldest rocks on Earth.
I guess water is liquid, isn't it?
Well, some
got to have H2O. That's liquid.
You can have
liquid
ice
form.
Or steam.
Yes. All right.
So
okay.
Yeah. The oldest rocks date at 3.9 billion years in age, and rocks that date at around 3.8 billion years, we have chemical fingerprints in these rocks that indicate that life was present,
mm-hmm.
Likely single-celled organisms that engaged in photosynthetic activity. And photosynthesis is one of the most complex metabolic processes that we are aware of. And there's also evidence that these organisms could have extracted energy from the environment through chemical means as well. So you have evidence for a vast array of different metabolic lifestyles that were present early on.
Just a quick question here, Dr. Rana. This evidence that you're talking about of life and photosynthesis being very early on, where is this something that the field in general is – this is not disputed? This is one of the fixed pieces of information, or is this kind of a claim of creationists that – we're trying to force another.
No, this is well-established information. Now,
it's the same information they're working with.
Right. Now, there's individual pieces of evidence that some people will debate as to whether or not this is authentic. But when you look at the weight of evidence, it's very clear that life appears very early in Earth's history, far earlier than anyone would have initially thought.
Mm-hmm.
And Niles Aldrich, who we mentioned already.
From Harvard, right?
Yeah, called it one of the most arresting facts he's ever learned. Well,
mm-hmm.
he's not disputing the fact,
right.
But he just finds it extremely unpredicted.
Yeah, well, I guess
it's,
this is the point. The
unexpected.
It's unexpected because it's not predicted by his model, I guess,
which
makes it arresting for him. Isn't that right?
That's right.
It's one of those anomalies that they have to deal with that is completely inconsistent with the way things.
Now, what's also interesting, too, is, and this relates again to the early appearance of life on Earth, the more that we can understand about this, and we can infer a lot just from the chemical fingerprints, from the nature of the fossil record, it looks as if these very first life forms, even though they were simple single-celled organisms, were incredibly complex, metabolically speaking. And again, this is something, for example, Bill Schaaf, who's one of the world's leading experts in the early fossil record for life on Earth, argues that things were far more complex than he would have preferred,
mm-hmm.
but that, the data is undeniable, that these life forms were very complex early on. There wasn't very much time, if you will, for evolution to evolve these from relatively simple life single-celled organisms to more complex single-celled organisms.
Yeah, and there's another problem I want to get to in a minute. That was the first time I ever heard about this other thing was from Dr. Ross, and it really was fascinating for me. But I want to just address this one thing that might be confusing to people. We hear the phrase simple cell, and we think there's a simple cell. In fact, we're having a lot of discussion about embryonic stem cell research. What's this little embryo? 8 simple cells. You can fit it on the point of a pin. You can't even see it with the naked eye. It's so simple. Well, it may be simple compared to an adult human organism, but even that one simple embryonic cell ain't simple, strictly speaking. It's incredibly complex in its own operations, and this is what you're referring to its metabolic processes.
That's right. Exactly right. Even the simplest bacterium probably has anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 genes that are essential for that organism to function, and each gene equates to a protein, which would be viewed as a workhorse molecule in the cell. All the cell's processes and structures ultimately involve proteins.
Right, right.
And their activity.
You have a section in the book that deals with that complexity and the information.
Right. So, but that gives you an idea. Even the simplest life forms have around 1,500 to 2,000 different proteins that are carrying out different activities in order for the cell to survive. And the cell has to have a way to form a cell wall. Mm-hmm. It has to have a way to replicate DNA, to make proteins, to extract energy from the environment. And when you start adding that all up, even the most basic life forms are incredibly complex.
Many of our listeners have seen the video or the DVD, Mystery of Life's Origin, in which they use computer graphics to show even the most simple reproduction of a molecule or an amino acid, how complicated it is, mm-hmm. and how it's complicated in the sense that it needs all of these sophisticated cellular machines doing their work down there on a microscopic level to construct this thing. It's absolutely fascinating. And whenever I see that, I think, tell me there's no God, you know, because this is one of the things that's so obvious when you see the complexity. Here's the thing that I thought was very interesting I first heard from Dr. Ross. Even with all of this other information about when life seems to appear and the cooling of the Earth, you have these catastrophic events that are cleansing events that are astronomical, that is, they come from the space, essentially, that would serve to – and we have they leave a record that would serve to destroy, to cleanse any life that might have been developing up until that time. Tell us about that and how that represents
sure.
a very small window of time for right. for the origin of life.
In fact, the origin of life researchers refer to these as frustration events for the origin of life because they would essentially interrupt the process
right.
over and over again. And in fact, many origin of life researchers argue you really must have several different instances when life would have originated on Earth, not a single instance, which again is problematic mm-hmm. given how unlikely it is that life should even originate a single time through natural means. But as you're referring to, there are these impact events. Now, very early on in Earth's history, some of these impactors were enormous in size. Some were about 60 miles in diameter. And when something that large hits the Earth, it's going to totally vaporize the oceans on the Earth's surface. It's going to go from liquid water to steam. The rock on the surface and the subsurface of the Earth are going to be totally melted. And so these impact events were happening prior to 3.9 billion years.
So we have theological evidence that these things actually took place on the Earth,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay,
now,
well established.
Right. Now, interestingly enough, at 3.9 billion years, when the Earth is beginning to cool and the oceans are becoming permanently established, there's something called the late heavy bombardment, where there's something happens in the solar system that causes asteroids and comets to pelt the Earth, probably over 17,000 impact events over a very narrow window of time. This would have obliterated any life that would have been present on the Earth's surface. In fact, a paper just published in Science said that this late heavy bombardment likely turned the Earth's oceans into a sea of magma that would have been about 2,500 degrees Kelvin.
Hmm.
And would have been about 800 kilometers deep. Hmm. So the Earth's surface is essentially
– this is a cleansing event.
Nothing's going to live through that. Nothing is going to live through that.
Uh-huh. And so then – so you have these that you can track the date of, and then very soon after this, you have positive evidence of biological life in very sophisticated forms.
That's right.
That's the window we're talking
right.
about.
Right. We're looking at no more than tens of millions of years for life to emerge, not – a time span of a billion years. And
life to emerge in its complex form photosynthesis.
That's exactly right. So it's a very brief, almost non-existent window of time where there is a sudden appearance of complex life on Earth, very early in Earth's history, exactly what we would predict if our model is indeed correct.
I can see why this would be frustrating events for the other guys because that's exactly what it does, frustrate their models. Talking with Dr. Fuzz Rana, he's the author of Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. It's a great book. It's published by University Press. And we're talking about basically the backbone structure of it and the kinds of things he goes through. He's got all the detail here. It's very readable. Dr. Hugh Ross was also co-author on this. And if you want to know what's wrong with one pillar of Darwinism, that is the origin of life, if you want to know how to falsify Darwinism in one fell swoop, this book will help you to do that. Now, of course, the focus isn't Darwinism writ large. It's at the roots of Darwinism, but if you deal with the roots, you deal with the tree. That's the way it seems to me. We're going to come back and we'll have more conversation with Dr. Rana after these messages. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions, From Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and Is One Way the Only Way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kochel giving you something to think about every Sunday, 3 to 5. And you know what? In about 5 minutes or so, we'll open up the lines. You can get in the queue to talk with me for hour number two, 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Melinda, why don't you just open the lines right now and we can let people queue up here. We're in our final segment talking with Dr. Fazrana of Reasons to Believe on his new book, Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. It's just a great approach, dealing in a focused way with one of the most critical areas of evolutionary thinking, how we get life from non-life. How do you get living stuff from dead stuff? That's the kickoff to the enterprise. And if you don't have that, you know, it's kind of hard to say that evolution is a fact if you can't answer that question. And what we know now, and we've actually known this for quite a while, is Robert Shapiro wrote his book in 1989, Dr. Rana, on their side of things, saying we've got nothing, and nothing has happened in the last 15 years to improve the scene. And so this is a fruitful place to look at this, the whole Darwinian enterprise, and this is what you focused your book on. We talked about the two models. We talked about life appearing abruptly, the small window of time, the cleansing events, the complexity of life, photosynthesis right from the very beginning. But you got this problem, too, of where you get the building blocks. Where do you get the erector set materials to start building this thing? And this is, as you mentioned earlier, was the key issue, the biggest problem that Darwinian theorists have in their model trying to explain how we got this thing started.
Yeah, and this is something I think that everybody should be aware of, is that there is no evidence at all that there ever was a prebiotic or primordial soup on the early Earth. It's just simply no evidence at all. In the oldest rocks on Earth, we see chemical evidence that life was present. We don't see any type of chemical evidence that there was this soup that was present on the early Earth.
So no erector set, in other words. And the Miller-Urey experiment from the early 50s, you know, the life in the test tube kind of thing that a lot of people refer to, this depends upon the existence of that soup in some form, right?
Well, in fact, that experiment supposedly demonstrated how that soup could become established. And in fact, this Miller-Urey experiment is now known to be totally irrelevant to the origin of life because the conditions that Miller-Urey used in generating amino acids simply does not simulate properly the conditions of the early Earth now, as we now understand it. And if you take the conditions that we now know the Earth consisted of, those conditions are not capable of generating building block molecules. So this is important because this Miller-Urey experiment shows up in biology textbooks.
Still.
still, not to paint a conspiracy or anything, but this is oftentimes cited as being the chief evidence for the origin of life, is these Miller-Urey type experiments. But again, if this is irrelevant, in fact, about a year ago, Jeffrey Betta and Antonio Lascano, two longtime associates of Stanley Miller, wrote an essay in Science.
And Stanley Miller is still alive, I
He's
think.
Still alive.
Is he at University of San Diego or UCSD?
UCSD.
Right.
Commemorating the 50th year anniversary of Miller's publication of the paper, mm-hmm. and they actually acknowledge in the paper that nobody really thinks this prebiotic soup idea has validity anymore, and that his experiment really is historical.
It's kind of an odd way of celebrating it, right?
Yeah, but it's a historical experiment, mm-hmm. not an experiment that is an established scientific idea that has relevancy mm-hmm. today. And so, again, if you don't, and origin of life researchers simply just don't know where these building block compounds could come from. They're suggesting a lot of alternatives. You know, deep sea hydrothermal vents, volcanic emissions, even extraterrestrial delivery. But when you examine those different explanations, they all are mm-hmm. are lacking.
We'll talk about some of those more exotic things in just a moment. But there's another problem, and you deal with this head on, I think, in a way that's understandable. You talk about how proteins form, and proteins are very vital, and they're like a string of amino acids, and they spell out things, and they form in certain three-dimensional kind of configurations, and they fit in certain ways, and everything's got to be just right. And this really is the problem of information. And you talk about that in your book. How big of a problem is this?
Oh, this is an enormous problem in terms of how do you get the information content in DNA and in protein molecules, because these molecules are built by stringing together smaller subunit molecules, mm-hmm. and those subunits could be thought of like as being like alphabets mm-hmm. that would be linked together to form words.
And words into sentences and
right.
sentences into paragraphs.
And,
right.
and the probability of hitting upon a sequence of letters or elements or symbols or amino acids that contain information from all the other possible alternatives is so remote that, you know, information must come from an intelligent source.
Well, what about the monkeys at the typewriter business, and they could type out, given enough time, the works of Shakespeare? Is this urban legend stuff?
It is. In fact, there's an interesting experiment. I can't find it now, but at one time I hit upon it just recently on the internet. Can't give you a web address mm-hmm. where somebody was actually doing that experiment.
They had the monkeys?
They had the monkeys, and they were, you know, they were simulating that.
With the computer, right.
With that process. Yeah. And the best they did was to get 17 letters in a row from one of the lines of a Shakespearean play. Yeah. So.
But, of course, the problem, too, is you don't have unlimited time. You have this narrow window of time that we were talking about earlier, and that's what really kind of blows that one right out of the water.
Right. You know, it's interesting. The best calculation I've seen from a probability standpoint was done by Hubert Yockey in the late 70s, and then he later revised his work in the early 90s. And he estimated to get even the simplest protein, which would be about 100 amino acids in length, a prebiotic soup of 10 to the 44 amino acids.
If there was a prebiotic soup.
If there was one. And if they could react once per second to get that probability, it would take 10 to the 23 years in order for even a simple protein to form. Well, the universe.
That's a long time.
The universe is only 10 to the 15
yeah.
years, which yeah. means we've traversed less than 1/1,000,000,000th of the time you need to generate even a single protein
right.
by chance. So,
of course, now these guys know this, and they've this must be another frustrating event for them. And then you've got the work that's been done with the human genome.
Right.
That's what has that revealed in terms of the problems of that they face now with the
world? Well,
of life?
It's more the discipline that the Human Genome Project launched, which was a discipline called genomics, and that is a very powerful approach to identify what is the bare minimum requirement for life in its most in its independent form and its bare minimum form. And what's coming out of this work very clearly is that life, in order to be recognized as life, is irreducibly complex. Mm. Anywhere from about 500 different genes or 500 different proteins are required even to have life in its bare minimum form.
Simple cells.
But these life forms can't exist independently in the environment. They right. have to rely on the researcher in order to survive or another host cell. Mm-hmm. Life in its bare minimum form to exist independently is closer to about 2,000 different genes. So from that standpoint, again, in light of the probability of even generating a single protein, there's just simply no way that life could emerge through natural means.
Okay, now these guys know this. They know there are these problems. And what you've cited so far is not news to the community. But they've got ways of working around. They got some workarounds, so we're going to talk about some of these exotic explanations. But just give us a 60-second update here on how the models are faring. The RTB model, which is a version of an intelligent design / creationist model, those terms understood broadly, and versus the Darwinian model that has been in play for 150 years now.
Well, in the book, we basically see none of the predictions from the evolutionary model are being satisfied by the data at hand, whereas the predictions from our model are all readily satisfied, mm-hmm. are consistent with what the evidence shows. And our model is able to accommodate new discoveries. In fact, since the book has been written, there's been a number of very potent discoveries that further add support for our model. So mm-hmm. our model is accommodating new discoveries. The evolutionary model is not. But as we show in the book, that nothing that the evolutionary model predicts has been satisfied. In fact, it's the opposite. Every one of the predictions being invalid,
falsified,
should invalidate the entire model.
Right. Okay, but they got a workaround now. They got basically, as I read, two kinds of workarounds here. One has to do with what you call extremophiles, and the other one has to do with panspermia.
Right.
Tell us what those are.
Well, the idea with extremophiles is that if life originates under harsh conditions, how can we explain the origin of life? Well, we now have discovered a number of organisms, microorganisms, that can live under incredibly harsh conditions. And so the thought is, well, maybe—
hot, cold, acidic, alkaline,
right.
pressure.
Right. So the thought is maybe these organisms were the first organisms on Earth, mm-hmm. and that more moderate life forms evolved much later. So this, again, is arguing that, you know, because the conditions were harsh, maybe that's how life originated.
So it's a workaround only with one aspect of the problem. I mean,
right.
the complexity and all these other things
right.
doesn't deal with, but
right.
it's trying to dismiss one right. aspect, the harsh conditions.
Right, and just because life exists under those conditions doesn't mean it can originate
Warm.
Under those conditions. Mm. And in fact, when you look at the biochemistry, these organisms are carefully designed to live in these extremely harsh environments.
Mm.
And so you have extra demands on explaining the origin of life under extremophilic conditions, not to mention that the more harsh the conditions, the less likely these prebiotic compounds are to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really not a viable option, but origin of life researchers are being forced into that arena.
After the ISSOL in San Diego in 1999, the International Society for the Study of Origin of Life, we had you and Hugh on the show, I think. We talked a little bit about this. And you said that the big stars at the ISSOL in San Diego in 1999 was NASA. And why would origin of life experimenters care about NASA? This is the other workaround.
Well, because now that the evidence is so weak in terms of life originating on Earth, the hope is that maybe we could explain life's origin on Earth not as an origination event, but as an arrival event, that life originated somewhere else and was transported to Earth. And Mars is right now the chief candidate along those lines. But there's no evidence at all that Mars ever harbored life.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's been the Viking experiment in the 70s showed no life present on Mars. And this ALH84001 meteorite—
The Mars rock.
The Mars rock that everybody claims shows evidence for relic life on Mars— very quietly, the scientific community has systematically disassembled that case.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no evidence that life ever originated on Mars. Recently, this big hoopla about water on Mars really is being misinterpreted by the media because there is evidence for water on Mars, but just recently in Science, a litany of papers were published where they're arguing this water that we're seeing is really trace water. It's not evidence for a large body of water.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that we understand about Mars, the less likely it looks to be a life support.
I mean, when I think about
planet,
I think about this panspermia, the idea that life has come from other places. I think about the Mars thing. I mean, maybe water is necessary, but it certainly isn't sufficient for life. And okay, so you got iron ore that doesn't make a 747, but that's kind of, you know, we got iron ore, so the 747 must have come from what, you know. Non-design. The other thing is I'm not sure that this really solves anything by pushing the origin of life off of the planet.
It postpones the problem.
It just postpones
to another location, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. Now, don't they see this though? It just seems so obvious to me that this doesn't solve anything. You just move it to another planet, another solar system, another galaxy, whatever. you still haven't solved the problem.
Right. And what's interesting, too, is that people that are working in this area recognize a number of problems. The idea that life could have originated in another solar system, for example, and be in transport to our solar system. Again, I've seen talks given by NASA scientists showing just the impossibility of that scenario working. Mm-hmm. You know, and the most
just in terms of the transfer.
That's right. The transfer process itself, life couldn't survive that transfer.
But let me ask you a question, though. Dr. Ross has said in the past that he expects to find life forms on Mars, but his expectation is that they will have the Earth life signature, meaning they were actually transported from Earth to Mars, just like the Mars meteorite came from Mars to Earth. Now, this is, I think, to the rank and file, this is unbelievably bizarre. How do you get a rock from the surface of either Earth or Mars onto the other planet through naturalistic means?
Well, when a meteorite or some large object would hit the planet's surface, it's going to spew debris, and some of that debris will actually escape the gravity of the of Mars or Earth, and then it mm-hmm. becomes an object. Oops.
That's right.
Sorry, hit the microphone. It becomes an object.
An explosion there. Debris is scattering all around the studio right now.
Sound effects. But, right. You know, but some of it will escape the gravity of the body and then will be part of the interplanetary system.
It's like when a kid stomps into a puddle. That stuff flies everywhere.
It flies everywhere.
And so you've got this stuff flying into the interplanetary space, and solar wind or gravitational pull can take it into the atmosphere of the other
right.
planet.
And given the fact that the Earth has been loaded with life for the last 3.8 billion years and has experienced numerous collision events that would have spewed ejecta, is the technical term, into interplanetary space, it only serves to that Mars is going to be receiving a number of these impacts, as well as other planets in our solar system, other mm-hmm. objects in our solar system. Earth has contaminated the solar system mm-hmm. with life.
And so we should expect to find something, a contamination, but you're saying too that has limits, that it's not going to be intergalactic.
It's not going to be intergalactic.
Or intersolar system even within this
right,
galaxy.
Because if an object is the size of a meteor, there's just not enough stellar pressure to push it through interstellar space.
We are at the end of our time, and boy, I got a lot more to talk to you about, but we'll just have to let people read the book for themselves. Dr. Rana, thanks so much for your time here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And it was great having your daughter as well. The book is Origins of Life, Biblical and Evolutionary Models Face Off. It's a great read, NAV Press. If you want a great book to supplement your reading on the evolution problem, focusing in on the origin of life, boy, this one's right up to date. It's well organized, well researched, and well written. I commend it to you. Origins of Life, Dr. Fuzz Rana and Dr. Hugh Ross. We got another hour ahead of us, friends, and now it's your turn. Lines are open, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150. I'll talk to you right after this.
Lucy, you cannot be in the show.
All right, folks, we let you play this hour. I kept Dr. Rana to myself. That's R-A-N-A, by the way, if you're doing a Google search. With reasons to believe. Boy, they're doing great work over there. I'm Greg Kokel. This is hour number two for Stand to Reason. And we're going to take your calls in just a moment. You know, we're entering in and actually are in the silly season with the election. And it's not just candidates, but issues that are on the table, and the issues are often connected to the candidates. I can't speak about candidates per se because of our role as a 501c3 corporation, Stand to Reason, but I can talk about the issues and also somewhat about a strategy regarding how one votes. Now, I'm going to be talking about this more as time goes on and doing some more writing about it. If you don't receive our free training material in the mail, our newsletter and the other letter from me, you get each an alternate months. You can get that, no charge. You have to call our office, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, and sign up there, or probably, preferably, go to our website and register as an ambassador. It doesn't cost anything. It just allows you to get the full service of our website. And when you register as an ambassador, you'll automatically be receiving our materials for our monthly materials that we send out for Stand to Reason, our training material. one of the things that you'll be receiving 1st of September in a week or so is my article on embryonic stem cell research. It's actually a reprise of a piece I did a number of years ago, and I brought in new material, and I want you to read it because it will help you to understand what's going on in this issue. And there has been some turmoil about this in conservative circles, and what I want to speak to now more specifically before I get to the calls is not just the issue of ESCR, embryonic stem cell research. A lot could be said about that. We've talked about it before. I listened to Scott Ray this morning from Biola University, Dr. Scott Ray, talk at a church service about this, and there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And we'll be clearing some of this up because there is a ballot initiative that I think is deeply misleading here in the state of California relating to the issue. But I want to talk just very briefly about a strategic voting concern regarding Christians, and that is the that sometimes when Christians are thinking about casting their ballot, they think which candidate is on my side of a certain moral issue. And I certainly think that's a good moral question to ask, or a question to ask about voting. But I think that sometimes the response, the result is doesn't take into consideration other things that are critical. I guess to put it simply, I don't think that we should vote for the person who just simply shares our ideas, but rather we should cast the vote for the person who can have the strategically greatest impact for our ideas. Abortion is a good example, and we've talked about this in past elections. Do you vote for a candidate that may not be as fully pro-life, if you are pro-life, as you would like them to be? Maybe there is a pro-life there is a candidate that is fully pro-life from your perspective that, for all intents and purposes, is not electable. But there is another candidate who is not as fully pro-life, which is electable and much better off than the alternative from the competing party. So do you go with, quote-unquote, your conscience and vote for the one that is just like you in their views? Or do you, as some people put it, compromise and vote for the person who doesn't have the totally pristine pro-life view but is a better choice than the other alternative, given that one of these two candidates, the other two, are probably going to be elected? And my response in the past is that this isn't an example of prostituting your vote if you vote with the less pristine pro-life candidate, or the one that isn't fully pro-life, over and against a alternate that is really horrendous from your moral point of view. In fact, it is the moral, it is the correct moral choice, because our goal is not to just vote for the candidate that sounds like us. If we're simply making a statement, the goal is to have the greatest impact for good. I guess the simplest way to put it is our goal is not to make a statement, it's to make a difference. Now, with that in mind, I read an interesting piece in the Friday LA Times by Ramesh Panuru on stem cell moderation regarding Bush. That is, it seems like, though President Bush is a vigorously pro-life, I think would be a fair way to put it, he does seem to be compromising a bit on some aspects of the stem cell research. And those who look closely at these things can see that, and that annoys him. And Panuro's point here is that, you know, Bush should – he's on the fence after a fashion, and being on the fence has hurt him. It hurts him with the purists of the party, as it were, who see – some equivocation, playing politics. But I want to read a couple of paragraphs that I think are important in assessing that, because I was sympathetic to the concern about the moderation that hurts Bush, and I wish he'd, in a sense, get off the fence on some things. But then there are this other element, the political realities involved, has to be taken into consideration if, and listen carefully, friends, if your goal is to make the biggest impact, make a difference rather than just make a statement. Now, I think I have a moral obligation as a Christian to make the biggest difference. I can make grander statements by voting one way that may not make a difference at all. But by voting another way, which some might call compromise, I could make a greater difference for good, and that's what we ought to be after. And my suspicion is, at least in part, that what President Bush is doing in his more moderate approach to stem cell research that is not consistently pro-life from the perspectives of some is he's trying to make a difference instead of just make a statement. What it reminds me of is the founding fathers who knew that slavery was a grotesque evil. It had to be done away with, but they couldn't deal with it right then because first they had to form the Union. And in forming the Union, they knew that they would have to live with slavery a while longer, as it turned out, almost 100 years longer, before then they could deal with the slavery thing that was more consistent with some of their principles, the principles of some of the founding fathers. Panuro says this in his article, "The demand for perfect consistency should not, however, exclude the possibility of political prudence." And this is the seed I want to plant in your minds to be thinking about in the next couple months, friends, when you're thinking about casting your votes. "A pro-life president," he continues, "can reasonably decide for the time being to largely leave alone well-entrenched evils, such as common fertility clinic practices, while combating new evils to which the country is not yet accustomed, especially if the predictable consequence of tying the issues together would be to defeat the defeat of both." And it may be, for example, that President Bush is just simply saying, look it, I can't fix everything right now, but what I can do is I can close the door to things getting worse. Now, for some of you who want to see a consistently pro-life president, you're thinking, well, you should be dealing with everything completely, or else it's compromise. And his response would be, if I tried to do that, I wouldn't get anything done. I would make a statement, not a difference. And that's the way Panuro is arguing here in this article. Let's see. He continues, "It would be a curious sort of principle of political morality that required people who held it to act in self-defeating ways. Bush's policy is also defensible as a way of avoiding complicity with evils that cannot be prohibited. By limiting the research subsidies to stem cells taken before the subsidies were announced, he does not reward or induce more embryo destruction. At the same time, he declines to make taxpayers who strongly object to the embryo killing research pay for it." Now, this plays off the point that the president made a couple of weeks ago on national TV with Larry King, that embryonic stem cell research is not illegal. What's at issue here is whether the government's going to fund it. Now, of course, a lot of pro-lifers would like him to make it illegal, and it may not be possible to make that illegal for now, but at least he can do is close the door on government funding. It's a provisional step. It's a step in the right direction. And I think we should be charitable to politicians who are trying to do that. And in fact, I think it should be an element of our own decision-making when we cast our votes in a couple of months. He adds here, and I'll close with this thought, from Ramesh Panuru, Friday's LA Times, "In this situation, a pro-life president has a delicate task of persuasion and incremental change, of nudging the country toward greater respect for the principle that early human lives deserve legal protection." I believe in incrementalism, ladies and gentlemen. I know for many Christians this is a dirty word, but I don't see any other way to have the greatest impact. I have written a piece. I think it's on the website. It's called Making a Difference or Making a Statement, something along that line, where I cash this out in more particular terms. I will be talking about it more as the weeks go on and we get closer to election time. I am convinced that elections have turned on the reluctance of Christians to, and I'm putting scare quotes around this, to compromise their votes. And so what they did is they made what they consider the conscience vote and ended up making a statement instead of making a vote that could have made a difference. And as a result, evil prevailed. These kinds of decisions require more careful and I want to say principled, but of course both sides are based on a principle. But careful, more careful assessment. It's not just enough to say that guy believes what I believe in, so I'm going to vote for him. You've got to ask what could be the greatest impact of the vote that you cast in, what, 6 weeks? Is it 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so? Beginning of November, it's almost September, October, say 9 weeks. That's the question. And I'll be pressing that issue as time goes on. But now it's time for our callers here. So let's go to Longmont, Colorado, and Kevin. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Kevin.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking the call.
You're so welcome.
I was wondering what your feeling is about this. It seems to me that when we say as Christians, put your trust in God and stop there, it seems that it's somewhat incomplete. And the reason I say that is because it seems like it should be put your trust in God for something. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, the phrase put your – Melinda, I need a pen. I'd lost mine. I don't know where it went, but excuse me for the asking for that. The phrase put your trust in God is certainly a complete sentence. It is a little bit vague, and this is the case with a lot of – thank you – with a lot of Christian slogans. I am concerned with slogans because I think that they are meant to do work that clearer thinking would be better suited for. Slogans just substitute. Oh, just put your trust in God. And because my question is going to be, and I think this is what you're getting at, what the heck does that mean?
Right.
In other words, what does it look like in my circumstances to put my trust in God?
Right.
Now, I think it's appropriate to say put your trust in God in circumstances when you are immobilized.
Okay.
All right? And then you have no recourse but to simply let God do it all. The problem is there is a – and I encountered this as a very young Christian 30 years ago, and it was a hard row for me to hoe, frankly, a kind of a deeper life, all of God, none of me – let go, let God kind of approach to Christianity, in which the Christian is not to do anything and God is to do everything.
Right.
And I actually don't think that is a sound approach to sanctification. And the reason I don't think that that's a sound approach, I think we are saved by grace entirely, unilaterally by God, monergistically as it were. God's the one who does that. I don't help him. I don't think that's the case, strictly speaking, in the area of sanctification. I think sanctification is a partnership.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because the Bible is thick with things that we were told to do.
Okay.
And the expectation is that we can do those things now with God's help, not apart from the vine, but abiding in the vine. And our working along with God, working out our salvation with fear and trembling, because it's God's at work within you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. There's this ineffable way that God works through us to accomplish these things, but our efforts are involved. And frankly, when people would tell me things like, you know, just trust God, or Kokel, you just want to be in control too much. You've got to let go and let God. And my response is, would you tell me what that means in plain English? Right now I'm facing a problem. What does let go and let God, or as you put it, put your trust in God, look like for me right now in this circumstance?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if it's valuable, at least for me, to somehow assemble a list of the things that I can trust God for, because it seems like, you know, people say, well, I'm trusting God to take care of my health or to take care of my finances. Well, I don't really see that necessarily true. I know I can trust God.
It's not God's job to take care of your finances in that sense, you mean, or your health in that sense?
Right. I mean, I guess to get to the bottom line, it seems like I can trust God for eternal life, and beyond that, there's not much more.
Well, yeah, well, this is where I think that the phrase is not helpful because it's obscure. It's not clear. It's ambiguous. And so a moment ago, I made an attempt to try to bring more clarity to it when I talked about when you trust God in that sense. It's when you are locked down and you can't do anything.
Right.
I remember, for example, I was speaking at an event in early June, and it was something that was scheduled for two years ago. I was speaking at a high school graduation, and there were like 3,000 people waiting to hear me, and I showed up at the wrong location. Now, I didn't do that on purpose. I had n- I we just got bad information. And I'm sitting there in front of this church when the event was actually at a different venue across town, about 20 miles away. And I'm sitting there in front of this church. I pull up there, and I'd got there, you know, way in advance to make sure I'm there and everything. I went to eat, and then I got back, and nobody's there. And then I see on the sign that there is this, it's going to be held at this, and then there's some acronym for some other venue across town. Now, I'm out in the desert. I don't know where any of these things are. I was locked down. I called the enforcer. She didn't have any more information. What am I going to do? I had no recourse at that point but to trust God, which means that I couldn't do anything. He had to do everything.
I see. All right? Sovereign will type of thing.
That's it. And I shot up a prayer. And right after I shot up that prayer, a car came into the parking lot looking for the same event that I was looking for. And the woman said, "Where is everybody?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm supposed to be speaking." She said, "Well, I'm playing the organ or the piano." And I said, "The only thing I know is up in the marquee there say it's supposed to be at this other place." And she goes, "Oh, I know where that is. Follow me." Okay. And so we got there in plenty of time and everything worked out. However, even in other circumstances, we are to trust God, but we are to trust God in the partnership. See, it's always good to say trust God. All right. Sometimes we must trust God wholly and entirely. That is, there is no other recourse than God doing 100%. That was my circumstance there. Other times we are to trust God when part of the responsibility is ours too. So I can trust God with my finances, but I go look for a job.
Right.
I try to make wise investments. I can trust God with my health, but I try not to eat junk food. So there is a partnership there. So trusting God we trust God in both circumstances, but it looks different in each circumstance. And my concern is when people say, just trust God, they have not thought through the distinctions between those two things. And they act as if you shouldn't be trying so hard.
I see.
Just let go and let God. Of course, it's easy for them to say because they don't have to suffer the consequences of inappropriate inactivity, from decisions to trust God and not do anything. The advice is cheap for them. It's hard for us because we have to employ that. And I think part of the problem is this misunderstanding of the way the Christian life is to be led. There are times we're forced into inactivity and we have no recourse but to trust God as the only one who can act on our behalf. And there are other times when we trust God as the one who's working with us in partnership in some endeavor, whether our health or finances or other things.
That's a very interesting way to put it. I hadn't thought about that. It seems like even that comes back to a sovereign will thing where you humbly do what you think you should do in wisdom, but yet you still trust God.
Absolutely. James says, don't say, I will go to this city and do this or that. That's boasting and that's evil. Say, if God wills, I will do this or that. So it's not the planning that's wrong. It's the attitude of planning without the consideration of God's sovereign hand in your life.
Right.
Okay, Kev.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk to you, and I hope that helps. We'll be back with more calls at 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code 754-4150 right here on Stand to Reason.
How would you like to spend a week aboard one of the finest ships in the sea cruising the Alaskan coast along with some of the brightest minds and skillful teachers in the world of Christian thought? Sound like a dream? Not anymore. Stand to Reason is having a cruise conference unlike any available today. We leave out of Seattle August 7, 2005 for 8 days aboard the MS Amsterdam. My friends J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig, and Craig Hazen will join me in bringing you the tools and skills you need to confidently give an answer for your faith in the 21st century. Stunning ports of call, breathtaking scenery of the Alaskan coast, stimulating sessions with our speakers. This cruise is for you. Want to learn more? Call Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. Their skilled staff will answer all your questions. Call them. There's no obligation. That's 800-247-1899. An Alaskan cruise, it's no longer a dream. It's for real. August 2005 with Stand to Reason. Call today, get a brochure, and I hope to see you there.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
What a day this has been. What a rare mood I'm in. Why, it's almost like being in love. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love.
Welcome back to the School of Clear Thinking Christianity right here in Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, every Sunday, 3 to 5. And, of course, we take your calls, comments, reflections on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. My conviction, Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas when it's properly understood and properly articulated. That's part of our job here, is to help you to understand it better, more accurately, and to articulate that as well. And, of course, part of what we need to do is to take slogans that have substituted for clarity in the past, like just trust God, our last caller's comment or question, break that down a little bit and talk about what it is that we mean by that. Sloppy language produces sloppy thinking, or sometimes it's sloppy thinking that produces sloppy language. We want to be careful in both of them, and that's what we're doing here. Okay, let's go to Ames, Iowa, and Brad, we're moving around the country here. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg.
Hi there.
A water line just broke in my basement here. Sorry about that.
Are you treading water?
Yeah, a little bit.
Sorry.
That's no problem. I just fixed it.
Oh, okay.
Actually, do you remember when you were out here a couple winters ago?
I do. I had a wonderful time out there with you guys. We had a great massive group of people, about 600 or so, or 500. They came in a blizzard.
I was one of those you introduced to apologetics that weekend.
Oh, that I was a wonderful time there at Ames, and we had a retreat then after that event, and it just was one of the highlights of my year. I had a great time with you guys.
Yeah,
love to come back, by the way.
Okay, well,
I'll spread the word.
My wife just took on a seventh grade science position,
mm-hmm.
and she's kind of faced with whether or not to present evolution.
Public schools?
In the public school, yeah.
Okay.
And She's got the ability to skip it. They aren't really going to care either way. But she's got about 120 kids that she teaches. And I'm just kind of curious what your opinion on what to do in that situation would be.
Well, this is an interesting – is it public school, presumably?
It's public school, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And it's interesting that they are pretty sanguine about whether she teaches – evolution or not. Now, seventh graders, this is the science portion of the curriculum. Is that right? Or is she in a science class? I'm trying to think. Seventh grade. I guess we used to rotate to different classes in seventh grade.
She's got five different classrooms of it's all the same science.
So she's the science teacher for the seventh graders.
Right.
Okay. Great. My conviction about this, even with Christian kids, is that we should not isolate kids from ideas. We should instead inoculate them. That is, you give them the real McCoy, but you also give them the things that are wrong with it. Now, I realize that your wife is in a public school, so she may be limited to how much she can say. But it seems to me it would be perfectly appropriate. If I were in her shoes, I would probably try this. To teach what is age-appropriate for Darwinian evolution, so that they understand the concepts, but then be very upfront with peer-reviewed scientific literature of what the problems are. Last hour, maybe, Brad, when you were on hold, you probably heard a portion of the interview that I had with Dr. Fuzrana,
yep,
on his book on the origin of life. So when she teaches that, you know, the Darwinian model entails life coming from non-life and these kinds of things, I think it's fair to say is now the part of the difficulty is that there's a very small window of time when this could have happened. There's not enough time for things to have happened by chance. You've got, you know, you don't have Darwin's pond or the building blocks that they thought that they would have. The Miller-Urey experiment, if it shows up in their textbook, you know, life in the test tube from the early 50s. Well, this has been discredited, you know. So you could say here are the ideas and here are the difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is completely defensible. I don't think that there is any educational curriculum that prohibits her from that officially prohibits her from offering a critique of the ideas that are from established scientific literature. If your books have the peppered moth examples, you know, like they talk about the peppered moth from England. Do you remember that from when you were in school? As an example of evolution?
I didn't get any of that.
Well, the moth is on the side of the trees during the Industrial Revolution, and the white moths, the black moths get eaten, and the white moths get eaten because the trees are black, and then the moths turn black, and then the trees get cleaned up, and then the black moths are eaten, and they turn back to white. And this is this illustration of evolution, supposedly.
Yep.
Okay, and of course, this has been thoroughly discredited by naturalistic scientists. This is just a complete farce. So it's appropriate when you've got these kinds of things in the textbooks that are offered as evidence for evolution, which turn out to not be good evidence for evolution, and even the evolutionists know this, then it's appropriate to tell the students, here's what they teach, and I'm telling you what they teach, now I'm going to tell you what they say is wrong with it. And probably a good source book for this kind of material, since it really is focusing in on the icons of evolution, is the book called The Icons of Evolution. And it looks at these kinds of evidences that are often offered at a seventh grade level as proof of evolution, and it tells what's wrong with them.
Okay.
And the footnoting is good, and the material is reliable. So I would encourage you to get the book Icons of Evolution. And Jonathan Wells. There it is. I mean, I was just going to say I can't remember, but Jonathan Wells is the author.
You think about using some of Darwin's quotes just along the lines of, that he said if anything could be found that was irreducibly complex, his theory would break down.
Well, I think that's helpful when it's age appropriate. I don't know that seventh graders are going to understand. Well, now I think about it, I think seventh graders could understand irreducible complexity. The mousetrap illustration that Behe offers is a good one to understand it. So I think it's a good one, and if your wife feels that her educational skills and her students are up to the concept, there's nothing wrong with that. I think we have to be careful with how we use Darwin, though, because as some people have suggested, when Darwin was old, he repudiated his Darwinian evolution. Now, I don't know that this is true. I think this is apocryphal, but even if it were, it means nothing. Just because he changed his mind doesn't mean the evidence is not good in favor of it. You can't deal with Darwin's opinion about it. You have to deal with the evidence as it stands right now. And so you want to be careful that you are quoting Darwin in a way that speaks to the question of the evidence, which I think your illustration, your quote, did. But there are other quotes people use of Darwin, I think, that miss the point.
Yep.
So I would go, if I were her, if I had freedom to critique it in ways that were sound, that were come from peer-reviewed material, and I think what Icons of Evolution, the book by Jonathan Wells, does is give you the bib sources for that, gives you the critique and also the resources for it. There's also a DVD for that.
Okay.
Which, and you can contact Stand to Reason. Go to our website at str.org, and we have
very
the book.
Very familiar with your site.
Good. Okay. We have the book and the DVD. Here's what's neat about the DVD. In the DVD, you have the foil for the story of the Icons for Evolution, this documentary. The foil is a true story about a high school teacher who did just what I'm suggesting that your wife do and got himself into a big bunch of trouble for doing it. But that's why if you have a school system that is amenable to this, then there shouldn't be any difficulty. But there shouldn't have been, even under the circumstance that this man faced, because he wasn't teaching creationism. He was critiquing evolution with peer-reviewed material. And, of course, the local folk couldn't even stand that. And it's a very interesting kind of docudrama that you see unfold on the video. So I would suggest get the video and get the book and then use that as a platform so that your wife can't be accused of robbing the kids of a vital education.
Right.
But she doesn't have to indoctrinate them either. She can say, okay, this is what they think. It's like saying this is what the communists thought, and here's what was wrong with it, or the Nazis, or whatever. You can give the ideas. and then give the refutation without asserting an alternate. Let them fill in the blanks for that.
So you'd say to just steer clear of intelligent design?
I would, under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Because they're going to find it out themselves. If they are if they see, like, this isn't going to work, I think it's natural for them to go to the only other alternative, intelligent design. Or she might make some offhanded references to it that are consistent with the teaching protocols of her community.
Right.
That's the concern I have. The point I'm making is I think it's possible to work within the protocols and still do appropriate damage to the idea of Darwinian macroevolution. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, Brad, tell your wife I said hi, and tell the folks over there at the, what do they call it, Truth Bucket, right?
Truth Bucket, yeah. Actually, I lived with a few of those guys.
Yeah, well, give them my best and tell them I'd love to come back again, even if it's snowing.
Okay.
Okay, Brad, take care. Right. Yeah, that was a great group of people. Some of you might recognize the name Truth Bucket because not only did I teach at Ames, Iowa to that Christian group there, but a year later I talked about an article in the is it the University of Iowa or Iowa State in Ames? I can't remember which one it is, but it's a campus town. And the campus paper had an article about these guys that had received some training from Stand to Reason, but they're pretty sharp on their own, and they were aggressive Christian ambassadors, and they were making a difference. And the article was actually quite complimentary to their efforts as Christian witnesses and what they're doing. Plus, they also, and this just goes to show how important, you know, both hands and feet are in mouth working in this enterprise. They also had taken on the task, the unpleasant task of cleaning cleaning the stadium after every football game. Now, they got paid for it, but it wasn't the kind of thing that people like to do. And they stepped up to the plate, and they had a very good reputation in the community because they did this for people with a smile. Reminds me of the Youth with a Mission crowd who I worked with to some degree when I was overseas. They had a great reputation. When I say crowd, I didn't mean that pejoratively. They had a great reputation because they would work on the border when shells were coming in from the Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge, and they'd cover during the shelling, and then they'd go about their work. In Hong Kong, I think it was, they were the group. You know, when you're in a refugee camp, there's a lot of people there, all right? And you got to take care of a lot of things needed to take care of a lot of people, like food and water and toilets. You know, in the refugee camp I served, they had 18,000 Cambodian refugees. So some of these camps got a lot of people. That means a lot of toilets. It means a lot of mess is what it means. And the Youth with a Mission people were the ones that were willing to go in and clean those toilets. And when they did that, they earned the respect of those people around them. So, and it gave their witness an entirely different impact. So just keep that in mind. You know, this is what we want to do. It's not just mouth, it's hands and feet too, okay? So we're to take this message, but what we do with our hands and feet, how we comport ourselves as ambassadors, and this is the character element that, of course, we talk a lot about here at Stand to Reason, how you comport yourself as an ambassador. Is going to say as much, if not more, about the legitimacy of your message than just what you say. All right? So keep that in mind. Let's see. Shall we go to Hugh? Want a break? Okay, we're going to go to Hugh in just a moment. Why human value is different than animal value, and then Ken, how long has man been on Earth? And we'll get your calls too, 1-800-227-5278, right here on Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions, from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and is one way the only way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me?
Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, equipping you to think every weekend on Stand to Reason, Sundays 3 until 5. And we have Orange County lines open in the 714 area code. If you're located there, you can dial up toll-free 754-4150. Going to Hugh in somewhere. Hugh, welcome to the show.
Hey, no. How are
you doing? I heard the hey, and then I heard a click out, so...
Oh. I called you nowhere, man. Anyway, the joke is a lot.
Yeah, there's not always a connection between the music. I just like the Beatles stuff, so we play
too.
That stuff.
Me
but,
too.
But you're not the nowhere man. I'm not the nowhere man. But there are a lot of nowhere men out there, and there's a lot of empty selves, and we're trying to deal with it.
You just killed my joke. But
oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. Basically, I talk to a lot of people that believe that animals are no different than humans.
Mm-hmm.
And... when I give examples about how animals act in the wild, how vicious they are, how much, for example, the whole marriage issue, I mean, the dating process, for example, I guess, if that's a good argument.
Mm-hmm.
They'll bring up an example about how, human beings go out and have sexual relations with just as much frequency without the marriage construct as much as animals do. So it just seems like it's like a circular reasoning or a vicious cycle where,
you can't make any headway on this one.
Exactly.
Okay, well, let me suggest a couple of things. What's at issue here is whether or not human beings are distinctive kinds of creatures, and we're not talking quantitatively here, we're talking qualitatively. Because this is the claim that Christians are making, that there is a big divide between human beings and all other creatures. We share a certain creatureliness with them, an animal nature of sorts, but there's something distinctive about human beings that sets them entirely apart. What is that, and why would somebody say that? Let me tackle the second thing first. The reason that somebody would say that is because it's obvious. And this is one of those issues that I deal with where I kind of get caught a little flat-footed. That's like somebody saying, prove to me that rape is wrong. I say, prove to you that rape is wrong. You know what rape is, right? Yeah. I mean, just picture it for a moment, this kind of violation of another human being. Okay? I'm picturing it. Can't you see that that's evil? If you can't see that that's evil, I don't know what I can tell you that will convince you. There are some things, I think, that have certain self-presenting qualities to them. And therefore, we know them immediately. We don't know them as a conclusion to a series of a discursive thinking. We're going through steps thinking, and we come to the conclusion that rape is wrong. We look at the thing. We say it's wrong. It is wrong in itself. It's a foundational kind of thing. This is what we mean by intuition, in this case, a moral intuition. Now, I think it's the same kind of thing that naturally informs our understanding that human beings are not animals. We tell people, don't act like an
animal.
Animal. Why do we say that? We are creaturely in some sense. The reason we say this is because we have a sense that human beings are different. Animals rape each other. You can have a strong male that overcomes a less willing female and take advantage for his solely for sexual gratification. Okay. Now, we wouldn't call that rape because rape is a word that has moral connotations to it, and morality doesn't seem to apply to animals. But we would descriptively, it's the same thing. A male forces himself upon an unwilling female to have sex with that female for the sexual satisfaction that it brings to the male, whether it's the pleasure or the power or whatever it happens to be, you know, establishing your position in the herd, however it happens to be, it gets something for that male. And the actions, the descriptive behavior is the same in both cases. Now, why do we call one wrong and the other one not? Why is it wrong? It's immoral, an act of violence which one ought not do to another human being in the case of humans. But this doesn't seem to even apply. It's a category error with regards to animals. And the answer is because human beings are different. And if human beings aren't different, then you different in this vital sense. And by the way, you can't say they're similar just because they have as much sex as anything. There are moral rules that apply to human beings, even with regards to the frequency of sex, that don't apply to animals. Now, you might say, well, the frequency of sex is not one of them because animals have sex whenever they want, and it gets down to it, humans have sex whenever they want. Well, even though you can find some similarities, you're always going to find a dividing line. The fact is, humans can't have sex any way they want. They know they can't. There are moral constrictions there. We don't have sex. We don't have sex with somebody else's spouse. Why not? Because there's a promise not to do so. Now, some people do break the promise, but when they do, we understood they've done something wrong. And it's the breaking of the promise in the context of sex. We don't force sex on other people. That's wrong. So there is in the process of reflecting on humanity, what it means to be human, we conclude that there are some things that are true about human beings that are not true about animals, and that this makes humans quite a bit different than animals. And in fact, your friends, I bet you would acknowledge that. What is the reason why they want to make animals and human beings the same level? What's the outcome of this discussion much of the time?
That's an obvious one. But people have a whole relativistic notion that who are you to judge my lifestyle? You know, just the people that really emulate TV programs like, you know, Friends or Sex in the City, where these single people just live single until their late 30s or 40s.
Okay, well, let me get to this in a second, because you said this was obvious, and I don't know if it was obvious to all listeners. I mean, the reason that they do this is because they think that human beings are mistreating animals, and humans aren't better than animals. Therefore, humans have an obligation to treat animals with more respect. Well, animals don't seem to have that obligation to us. Why do we have that obligation to them? And so even at the foundation of their enterprise, there's a conflict there. On the one hand, they want to say that we are both the same, and then in the next breath say, well, we're not the same. We have these obligations towards these critters because we are the same. Well, this is self-contradictory.
Right.
And then they run into the exact same situation if they're simply going to limit their objection to who are you to judge? Because there's a subtext to this. The statement seems to object to the moral judgment, right?
Right.
Like that moral judgments are inappropriate. Okay? But isn't what is the subtext to who are you to judge? The subtext is that you ought not judge. It's wrong for you to be judging. So they complain about judging people, but their complaint is itself a moral judgment. See, they can't get away from the fact that human beings are, in fact, different. even when they try to deny it. And anyway, who are you to judge? I've written about this. You can look it up on our website. This is a nonsense question. Who are you? Well, I'm not claiming to be anybody. I'm not the boss to judge. I am in a position to make sound moral assessments. And here are the reasons for my assessments. The same reason that the same position they are in to make moral assessments. Now, I can make sense of my moral assessments, the fact that I make them. They can't. If they think that we should just live like animals, well, then punch them in the nose. Belt them. You know, you say, you know what, I just was really annoyed by what you said, and I just let my animal nature take over. Animals respond with impulse. They get mad, they snarl, they strike out, they draw blood, then they walk away satisfied. That's what I just did with you. What's your beef?
Okay,
see,
yeah,
that's called taking the roof off. You know what I'm talking about? Now,
right, right.
Don't hit them, you know, but I think that's a point that you can press.
Okay.
These people cannot get away from the fact that human beings are different, and they are different in substantive ways, and we're not just more highly evolved. By the way, that statement is when you're talking about contemporaneous creatures, that creatures living at the same time, is nonsense. There is no such thing as anything that's more highly evolved if both are surviving at the moment, because all evolution is about survival, and if you're both surviving, then you're equally highly evolved. This
right.
highly evolved is a way of smuggling in some other kind of concepts that are at home in a Christian worldview. Human beings are different, they're better, but aren't at home in their worldview at all.
Oh, I see.
And so what I'm looking for is all of these things that they say that end up affirming my worldview. Now, one last move that they might make, and I'll toss this out to you, and you can think about this when you have the conversation. Why is it that we have a moral nature and animals don't? Why do I have moral obligations because that animals don't have? And then they're going to throw in this more highly evolved business. Well, as I mentioned just a moment ago, this is nonsense. What do you mean highly evolved? That doesn't mean anything. Evolution cares about survival. We're both surviving, getting our genes in the next generation, so we're not more highly evolved. Yes, but we have developed rationality, okay? My question is going to be, tell me the connection between rationality and morality. Now, the answer is there is no connection between them. And some very smart people have made this mistake. They think that human beings, since they've, on their view, evolved the ability to be rational, that rationality dictates morality. But this is false. Morality and rationality are both understood through separate and distinct intuitions. And let me give you an illustration for that. You with me so far on this?
Yeah.
Hugh? So yeah. Let's just say, Hugh, that we see a woman that's really, really beautiful. I mean, let's just say she's gorgeous. Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is in the face of this woman. She's gorgeous, all right? Now, do you think that somebody who is not as bright as you or I would be able to perceive the beauty as readily as we would?
Yeah.
Okay, and so somebody that's smarter, are they better able to perceive the beauty?
No.
No, you see that nothing about our smarts or the laws of rationality factor into our ability to see to recognize something as beautiful.
Right.
Our ability to recognize beauty is a function of an intuition. It is an aesthetic intuition. Our ability to recognize good thinking and rationality is a function of our rational intuition. And our ability to recognize whether a thing is right or wrong is a function of moral intuition. You don't have a better take on morality because you're smarter. There is no connection, and all I can say is just think about it for a moment, and you'll see that rationality, the laws of logic, the ability to reason, has no relationship to whether or not it's right or wrong.
That's a good point.
To kill an innocent human being.
Okay.
It's just simply unrelated, okay? These are and I don't know how else to say it but to say it that way. It's a separate intuition. And this is part of the problem with scientists making decisions about embryonic stem cell research, because the discipline of science relates to their rationality. You know, what are proper conclusions to draw from the evidence of experimentation and the scientific method? But nothing about the enterprise of science, which relates to rational intuitions, can tell you whether any scientific endeavor is a good one or not, morally speaking. That's a separate intuition. Scientists aren't in a privileged position to tell you whether embryonic stem cell research is a good thing or a bad thing morally.
Yeah.
And so I'd want to make this very clear that the ability to think rationally doesn't inform morality in any sense. It is possible to be a completely rational creature and not have any morality. Now, one last caveat is sometimes people want to argue that rationality dictates morality. They say, well, it's just all you have to do is think about it and you can see it makes sense. It's not a good thing to kill other people. And here they're simply confusing their access to their moral sensibilities, their moral intuition, with their access to their rational sensibilities. They are calling it a rational intuition, but it's not. What makes sense? It makes sense morally, not rationally. Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do see. Okay.
Yeah. So just keep that in mind when you're talking to them, and I think you'll have some productive conversations.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Hugh. It's a good call. And this, by the way, this mistake happens all the time. I heard it on a radio talk show in fact, Dennis Prager's show recently, and I think Dennis is fantastic. I love listening to his show. I benefit greatly from it. I pattern my own show to a large degree after Dennis, who is now a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. Many of you know him, and I've been on his show in the past when he was local quite a number of times. But this came up on his own show, and look, you do not need a Bible to know what's right or wrong. All right. All you need to know, all you need to do is have a properly functioning, rational intuition. I'm sorry, moral intuition. Without the Bible, you can know what's right or wrong. Now, your intuitions built into you give you that capability. Now, the question is how, once you've seized upon the fact of morality that you know through your moral intuitions that rape is wrong, for example, that how do you ground that? Why is the world the kind of world in which rape is wrong and it's only wrong for human beings? That's the grounding question. And this, I think, you're going to have to go to an authority for the universe, in some sense, to ground that in God. Not necessarily in the Bible, but in God, who is the author of the Bible. Now, if God is the grounding for morality, the book he writes is going to reflect his moral point of view. And it's going to give you a lot more particularity about his moral perspective. But what it isn't going to do, what isn't the case is that it's necessary that you have the book to know anything that's moral. It isn't just a matter of feelings at that point. When you say, I don't decide on the Bible, I decide for myself, what may be being referred to there is people are just taking stock of their own moral intuitions, not merely their feelings. And that kind of thing, in my understanding, is completely legitimate. In fact, it's the only way that people can be genuinely morally responsible for their behavior. It's the only way that they can be held responsible by God for doing wrong things when they don't have a Bible to tell them what's right and wrong. The Bible, in that sense, the right and wrong, has to be written on their hearts, which is exactly what the Bible says God has done with morality. Is that the signal to the end of the show? I'll take it. That's all we got, folks. All right, friends. I'll be back with you next week. It's been a great great show and a great conversation. Do we got more time, or is that what's going on here? Now I guess we're out. Listen, this week, take what I've said into consideration. Talk with your friends about it. Go to our website, str.org. Learn some more. Be sure to sign up for Solid Ground Embryonic Stem Cell Research, the next Solid Ground coming out September 1st. You can do that at str.org and be a good ambassador with an accurately informed mind, knowledge, an artful method, tactics. Make that wisdom, tactical wisdom, and an attractive manner. That'll get it out. Character. I'm Greg Kokel for Standard Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider...
easy. Again, Stand to Reason is offering you high-impact training for free. These courses are available to anyone over the Internet. So visit us today at str.org. That's str.org and receive